We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talk to a U of I professor who's spearheading an effort to preserve the virtual worlds of old video games. We hear about a performance troupe who dress up like shrubbery, yes, shrubbery, to create truly unique impromptu performances. And we learn about the two-fisted liqueur known as Malort and a group of Chicagoans who are obsessed with it. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Citizens should be on the lookout. Shrubbery wearing striped stockings have been seen, well, stalking citizens on the East Coast. For 10 years now, from Rhode Island to Bethesda, Baltimore's Ambush Theater have been mixing puppetry, mime, and street performance techniques at festivals, museums, and graduations. More from independent producer Andrew Hiller.
Hey, how you doing?
High atop Federal Hill, overlooking Baltimore's Inner Harbor, vegetation is on the prowl.
Don't look now, there's dog poop again.
Are we witnessing some strange side effect of global warming? Or the opening scenes of a new horror movie, Attack of the Killer Shrubbery?
It was kind of creepy, actually. I didn't really know how to react.
One fact I'm definitely sure of is that when I grow up, I want to be a moving bush.
No, it's Ambush Theater and actors disguised as plants. They have performed everywhere from street corners to music festivals, even the USS Constellation. Today, Lois Tuttle invited the company to Federal Hill to be part of the entertainment prior to a charity walk for Crohn's disease.
I think they do something around the nature of causing mayhem and mischief through shrubbery dancing.
Amidst the grassy picnic area and winding walkways, the bushes lie in wait. Just typical green leafy plants with striped stockings that blend in pretty well if you're not paying attention. When a victim nears, they rise or creep up behind them, generating a startle or a laugh. But the group does more than just surprise its unwary victims. Annie Howe is head bush wrangler for Ambush Theater.
Well, like one bush will lay on the ground and the other bush will balance on its feet, or will do sort of like standing tricks where partners are, you know, one standing on the other person's hips or shoulders or something like that. So more of acrobatic stuff.
Did you decide to do this because you were a Monty Python fan and you just wanted to say the word shrubbery?
No, actually, I saw a fake plastic topiary boxwood at a hotel, and I thought, wow, it would be really funny if I made a costume that was a bush that would follow people around, and that was about as far as the thought process went.
Ambush combines Howe's two loves, puppetry and street theater.
In art school, I was trying to figure out how to kind of balance my interest in puppetry and working with people and performing, and this is sort of how it manifested in a class that I was taking. And ever since then, we just like to kind of create these kinetic landscapes that make people laugh.
Besides mimicking, stalking, and leading impromptu aerobics classes, the bushes also dig the standards.
We actually created a kinetic landscape that was the bushes and a lamp post costume on stilts and a mailbox and a traffic barrel, and we did a tribute to Singing in the Rain.
Back on Federal Hill, the bushes lie in wait by an iron fence. The sun is bearing down, so are two unleashed mutts.
It's so funny. Annie warned me that, like, the joke that almost everybody has to say is the one about the dog lifting its leg on you. And I did hear that about 25 times in the 45 minutes that we were out there.
Tuttle wasn't worried when she saw the unleashed canines approach the act.
I think their bark is worse than their bite, but yeah, I don't know, perhaps dogs and shrubbery might be a bit of a tricky idea.
I saw the dog and I wanted to pet it.
Parrish insists it's not the dogs you have to worry about.
There was a kid today who thought it was really, really funny. He did this on like four separate occasions, just come up and start poking me in the poke me in the back of the head. And it was incredibly irritating, but I just didn't respond and he eventually went away. You know, I think he was looking for some kind of violent bush reaction.
Hal says that street performers develop a sixth sense about danger and that none of her actors have ever been physically attacked. That isn't to say that being an ambusher and a mime comes without risk.
We were performing in Union Square as part of an outdoor festival, and the park ranger there didn't know that we were supposed didn't know what we were. And so the officer was further irritated by the fact that the bushes weren't communicating, and thankfully one of our friends that was with us sort of helped mediate the situation. And as this police officer was trying to kind of like kick us out of the park, all these people were just getting a huge kick out of it. And finally at the end she let us stay because she thought it was kind of funny too. So
while many laugh, others like Troy Sampson voice concern.
Yeah, because I'm wondering is it hot, because it is pretty warm out here today, so I'm wondering how they're doing underneath those costumes.
First-time Bush, Sarah Parrish, says Sampson's concern is on the money.
I expected it to be really hot in that costume, and it sure was. I just had a blast. I would do this again, for sure.
What did you learn? What are you going to change the next time you do this? In fact, in about an hour when you do this next.
I'm going to stay the heck away from that little pokey boy.
Always good advice. The Ambush Theater Bushes might be seen at the Strathmore Outdoor Concert Series in Bethesda this summer. Then again, they might be right behind you. Did you check for stockings? I'm Andrew Hill.
You're tuned to Sidetrack. Have you noticed crows acting strangely these last few months? Crows can get especially aggressive this time of year. Science reporter Audrey Quinn explores what makes crows such unique animals.
Last month, I saw a crow challenging a seagull to in-air combat on three different occasions. It got me wondering, what is going on with crows these days? So I started collecting other people's crow stories, like this one from my friend Eric Olson in Seattle's Queen Anne neighborhood.
Yeah, I was walking back to my office after eating lunch, and out of nowhere, a crow swoops and almost brushed the top of my head. I couldn't believe it, and came up from behind me, and I was so shocked. So for the extra rest of the block, I kept walking with my head turned around over my shoulder, staring at this bird, and it did that two more times.
I was walking down the street, and I heard a swoosh, and I felt something brush my hair. And as I looked up, there's this crow flying away. Okay, that was weird. And then, like, not even a minute later, as I'm still walking, another one comes and, like, swoops down and, like, got a little bit more of my hair. I ended up having four different crows total on my head.
That was another one of my friends, Jana Warner. She lives in Seattle's Capitol Hill. I wanted to learn more about this strange crow behavior, so I went to visit University of Washington professor Dr. John Marsland.
Hi there.
He's spent decades studying crows. I asked him if the aggressive crows in these stories were unusual.
I would suspect there's a baby nearby almost in all of those cases. Crows have a lot of guts. They're bold and they are extremely defensive. I mean, their whole strategy is to produce a few high-quality young. And if you only produce a few, you've got to really defend and take care of those few.
But sometimes crows just seem so knowing. Like in my friend Jacob Hemholtz DeLay's story of a gun-happy neighbor in Yakima, Washington.
He liked to shoot at crows with a pellet gun.
Why?
Couldn't tell you. He just didn't like them being on his fence, his tree, the power lines near his house. He actually killed one time. After that, it was pretty typical to see a line of crows near his property, either on the power line above, on the wooden fence, in the trees, looking in the direction of his property. I think they were reminding him of what he'd done.
Marsliff disagrees with claims of crow morality.
They can have some very, how should I say, forward-thinking sorts of activities, almost omnipresent activities, or omniscient activities, I should say, that really don't require knowing everything all the time.
That's disappointing.
I know it is. It's disappointing to me. But as we go through these stories and try to come up with explanations for why they may or may not be doing things, a lot of the explanations that you can't rule out are fairly simple.
Marslev adds that it's likely self-interest keeping crows around after another crow dies. They come out to survey the particular area, to make sure they don't meet the same fate. But then there are stories like this one from my friend Yosef Alton. He also lives in Seattle. It takes place after the death of his uncle, who really loved crows.
The morning of his death, there was this powerful moment when we all noticed that in the backyard, there was at least 40 crows, that they were all over the house. And they had started coming, I think, that week that he was dying, but then just this morning, it was unimaginable just how many crows could be here. It just didn't seem like it'd be a coincidence. And I think it did a lot of starting the healing process. I think everyone was upset, but felt like that the whole process was complete now, and that it was okay.
Marslev has a pragmatic explanation for that story, too.
The idea of crows associated with death and funerals, they are there at the time somebody has lost somebody important to them. They may be, but you can explain a lot of this stuff fairly simply, that because of our cultural interaction with crows over thousands of years, we have this almost a predisposition to see them when things go bad.
Marslev would suggest there might have always been a lot of crows around that house. Alton may have just been more sensitive to seeing these blackbirds after his uncle's death. The last storyteller I talked to was Chioctin Paul Wagner. He's of the Vancouver Island Saanich tribe. This crow story comes from his ancestors. It started out like this.
Long ago, the animal people lived. Long ago, the animal people lived. Long ago, the animal people lived. And there was Bear. Bear was getting ready to have his supper. And there he looked out, and he saw that number one nuisance. He saw Crow. And Crow had a real bad reputation.
Crow goes on to take Bear's food without properly returning the favor. Chioctin says the story was probably inspired by Crow's tendency to steal other animals' food. And here's where Professor Marslev sees crows as enchanting.
They do things that people have held on to for centuries. I mean, there are long-standing myths that I think have some connection to actual events that they saw crows and ravens do. Their curious and interesting actions cause us to think deeply and develop myths about them, and not many other animals cause us to do that.
Crow behavior itself may not be so unworldly, but the way crows inspire human interpretations, that's mythic. I'm Audrey Quinn.
You're listening to Sidetrack. In recent years, filmmakers in New Hampshire have been flexing their creative muscles, making shows for the web, and building devoted audiences for their content. Now, this loose-knit collective of producers is starting another series. Independent producer Avishai Artsy checked in on the auditions.
A zombie, an astronaut, and a Ghostbuster are rehearsing their lines. Crack Skull's Coffee and Books in New Market, New Hampshire is tiny, and tonight it's filled with hopeful actors looking to land a role in a new web television series called How to Survive the Strange.
It's basically Bob Vila dispensing advice on how to deal with zombies and vampires
robots,
and robots.
Campground slashers. Basically, it's Home Improvement meets the paranormal.
Those are the show's creators, horror film blogger Brian White and multimedia producer John Herman. They're sitting in a back corner of the cafe as actors take their turns auditioning. An assistant, Tara Sullivan, helps potential cast member Don Bryant read through his lines.
You got a million windows up here, all these windows. You gonna make them strong enough to keep them out?
And things ain't got no strength. Hell, I smashed three of them, pushed another one out the door.
I'm telling you, they turned our car onto its roof.
Hell, any five good men could do that.
Herman is looking for more. He gives Brian some advice.
This truck driver, even though this zombie apocalypse has only really been happening for a few hours, he is like a master. He is confident. Like, this guy is freaking out. you're showing a certain toughness in the face of paranormal disaster.
The actors may not all be shoo-ins for a Golden Globe, but then they're all volunteers, and the budget for the show is, let's say, minimal.
I've got maybe $4 in my pocket right now, and
I have nothing in my pocket right now, actually.
It's funny because we're completely confident. You have a good idea, and so many people want to get involved.
At least 50 people showed up for tonight's auditions, despite heavy rain and some flooded roads. The assembled actors offer varied experience. Joan Page of Epping played an extra in the film Paul Blart Mall Cop.
In the mall, I was in the restaurant scene. I was there for 2 days, getting like 1 second of half my face in the movie.
Chris Bradley acts in Seacoast Area Theater, but hopes this show will help him move forward in his career.
There's more people that watch the internet than go see live theater, I think, which to me is sad for theater. But in the same scheme, so many more people could see my craft now. If I get it, you know, they could branch out to so many more people.
Actress Dalia Mawat of Manchester doesn't really know what she's auditioning for, though she heard something about an alien invasion causing a family to break apart.
I'm hoping I get to play the part of an angry wife. I mean, who wouldn't be angry when aliens are just wrecking your house? So I think I could do it pretty good. I think I could pull it off.
Mawat is willing to take what she can get and says the new world of web TV allows actors to find roles without moving to New York or L.A.
People can travel if it's really necessary, but there's creativity everywhere. There's no need to restrict yourself to just one or two cities. I mean, you can live wherever you want.
And it's not just actors that show up. Sean O'Connell makes props in his garage and brought a few ray guns along.
Here's the steampunk version of a tricorder. A little damaged during some of the, altercations with some of these creatures. But still, it works nicely and it will warm cocoa.
Hey folks, Dan Froent here for Short Stream TV with Avishai Artsy from NHPR, right?
The show's director of photography, Dan Froent, films us with his cell phone. That's the emerging aesthetic of web TV, shot at a moment's notice and streaming online within minutes. The casting, filming, marketing, and distribution of web TV all cost little to nothing. Froent will distribute How to Survive the Strange on a site he built himself. Since his show Round the Square debuted in January, he says it's generated almost 300,000 hits.
You know, that's pretty good for a guy with a camera and a laptop, not much more.
John Herman also has a couple web series under his belt, a surreal musical show called Odd Noggin Land, in which the characters' heads are replaced by an oversized hamburger, packet of French fries, and a ketchup bottle, plus Gravity Land, an interactive series where the audience decides the plot.
When I was first making web video series, I didn't even do auditions because I had to spend so much time explaining to people what a web video series was. So I basically said, listen, you're going to act in my thing with a camera. It's like a movie. And then I'm going to put it somewhere.
It's going to be on the internet.
It's going to be on the internet. I don't need to explain that anymore. People get it. I think the filmmaking community has really come around, and they realize that you can spend years working on a film and get 50 people to see it, or you can make a web series and get thousands of fans within a few weeks.
The directors also expect to take turns in front of the camera. White will serve as the Bob Vila-esque narrator. Herman will probably make a zombie cameo at some point, and his 6-month-old son, Emrys, might just score a role, too.
There is an episode with a baby involved. A baby gets passed to an evil robot because it makes a good babysitter after it's been reprogrammed. So I suspect that might be an inside casting job.
Unlike network and cable TV, there is no promised production schedule for How to Survive the Strange. The crew hopes to have the first episode online soon. Meanwhile, auditions for zombies, aliens, and angry mob members will be ongoing. I'm Avishai Artsy.
This is Sidetrack. Every Sunday morning at 11, a mixed crowd gathers at Robert's Western World, a honky-tonk located in downtown Nashville. The crowd, an assortment of sober-eyed locals, drunk transients, international tourists, and a bald-headed priest named Father Ron, mingle together for the purpose of conducting a church service Before noon strikes, the bar opens and things go back to normal. More from independent producer Kevin Bolden.
There are two main reasons to go honky-tonky: alcohol and live country music. At Robert's Western World, the music is free. There's never a cover charge. Any day of the week, you can walk in, order a beer, listen to a show. But on Sunday mornings, the rules change slightly. For 1 hour, the bar closes. The music on stage turns gospel, and the entertainment turns to testifying.
Three words from the Lord, I heard them in 1978. I love you. That set me free.
That's Father Ron Blakely, the ordained priest who officiates the gospel hour at Roberts. 4 years ago, Father Ron began holding services at the Honky Tonk, full liturgical services, replete with a gilded chalice for sipping communion. These days, the weekly service is simpler. The tithe is collected in a plastic pickle jar, for instance, the same jar used to collect tips during normal hours. But as casual as it is, the sound of a priest conducting church in a bar still confuses some tourists who wander in unknowingly. Father Ron tells one story about a young man who stepped into the bar unaware.
I don't think he realized what was going on, and he grabbed a cup of coffee and sat down. Right at the time, I said, "Let's pray." And he went, "Oh, damn." Yeah, no idea. What did I get into? It was a long time ago when Lazarus died. Hope was gone, his sisters cried.
Like the prayers, the music of the gospel hour also sneaks up on some visitors.
Well, they listen to the music and it sounds country until somebody says Jesus.
John Shepherd has played the honky-tonks on Lower Broad for 37 years, and he's seen plenty of tourists shocked by the language of the gospel hour. They hear Jesus and have to decide if they'll stick around or move on.
They either settle for it and sit down and enjoy it, or they go back out, look for a drink somewhere else, because they're probably needing a drink. They've been hungover. You know, stayed up till 2 or 3 in the morning.
And they can find a drink if they want one. Some of the other honky-tonks, like Tootsie's, start serving at 10. But not everyone strolls Lower Broad in search of alcohol. Take John Matigue III, a gospel hour regular. He arrives outside the door of Roberts in search of coffee and a good word.
You come down here once a week and kind of fill your spiritual gas tank up for the week.
Matigue is the former drummer of Brazil Billy, the house band at Roberts, so he knows the nature of the bar, the laid-back vibe the bar has on a Tuesday afternoon or a Saturday night.
It's the same thing on Sunday morning, but just maybe a little bit less on the sin scale and the alcohol, you know what I'm saying?
For those like Matigue, who walk in and stay long enough to hear Father Ron preach, his sermons provide calming assurance. His style is simple, and it often sounds pastoral, in the literal sense of pastures and fields.
The best thing to do sometimes is to look outside yourself. Look up at the beautiful skies, the mountains, the trees. Forget about yourself for a while and shut that thing off inside of your head.
There's no forgetting the fact that Father Ron's pulpit is a performance stage. Instead of standing beneath a cross or a statue of the Virgin Mary like he would in a church, when Father Ron enters the pulpit, he steps into the shadows of a 5-foot-tall wax mannequin of Marty Robbins. And if the bar had a patron saint, it would be the late cowboy crooner. Photos of Robbins line the walls of Roberts, and there's not one picture of Jesus anywhere. But like the Gospel Hour singer Butch Wax says, you can worship the Lord in a cardboard box if you want to. This congregation happens to worship him in a bar.
We play gospel music in a honky-tonk downtown. We sing the words that Jesus said that will get you heaven bound. At 12 o'clock we close the Bible and order up the round. We play gospel music in a honky-tonk downtown.
And just like the song says, at 12 o'clock the gospel hour ends. The bar opens, and things go back to normal at Roberts. This is Kevin Bolden.
We got cheeseburgers and fries and live country music. The only kind of lunch you're probably gonna need. Cheeseburgers and fries. And if you forgot your glasses, go ahead and order up. Blame it on me.
Welcome to Roberts.
Nashville, Tennessee. Here today, oh, today, oh, today. you go.
Still to come, saving the virtual world of video games and the strange drink known as Malort. Stay tuned. You're listening to Sidetrack. Today, most people buy new things rather than repair things that break. One Connecticut businessman is disposing of our throwaway culture by repairing something most families refuse to throw away, their antique clocks.
My name is Raymond Pavkov. I'm a certified master clockmaker. My mom says when I'd get a wagon or a bicycle, first thing I'd do is take the wheels off and grease the axles. So working around gears and cogs all my life, I just kind of had an interest in it. The apprenticeship that I started with was with a master clockmaker out in Guilford. He was actually a seventh generation clockmaker, so he was very well versed in the art and the craft of clock restoration. The first thing I learned was by mistake, and that was before you take nuts and bolts off of a clock, you have to make sure that you've released all of the power. Because if you don't let down the spring, things will go flying. And I've picked up many pieces off of the floor in my first days. I hear a lot of sounds. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Da, 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 da. People often ask me, they say, how can you stand it? It's so noisy. To me, that's a baby's breath, you know. A clock becomes something in a home that's very soothing. It's not like a fire engine going past the front door. There's something very soothing about the constant tick-tock, tick-tock. Back in the 1880s, clockmaking is really what built Connecticut. We had clockmakers in Thomaston and in Farmington and Bristol and New Haven and Waterbury and Ansonia. If you're talking about clock repair shops, they're getting to be fewer and fewer. I'm not sure what the future is going to be. The kids just don't want to buckle down and really learn a trade. I think that there's pressure on them. You know, you have to have a master's degree in something, whether or not you ever use it. But a person that can work with their hands, I don't care whether it's outdoors, landscaping, or plumbing, or carpentry, or clock making. If you work with your hands, you'll never go hungry. I don't see myself doing this forever. I will probably cut back on the type of clocks that I take in so that my workload cuts down a little bit. But I can't see myself completely packing up my tools and selling them because I just wouldn't know what to do with myself at that point. There's something about that heartbeat, mechanical heartbeat, that is soothing. So I'll always enjoy it. I will miss it if I can't do it anymore.
That story from independent producer Patrick Scahill. You're tuned to Sidetrack. For today's gamers with their Xboxes and PlayStation 3s, the theme song to the first-person shooter Doom, first released in 1993, may not mean much. But it's actually one of the more recent games being protected by researchers at four institutions, including the University of Illinois. 3 years ago, the Library of Congress gave out a series of financial awards for the purpose of digital preservation. $590,000 went to the U of I and its partners for the Preserving Virtual Worlds project. The selected games go back as far as the early 1960s. Jeff Bosser talked with the project's coordinator, U of I Library and Information Science Professor Jerome McDonough.
All of these groups had, for one reason or another, started getting interested in the issues about game longevity and how you keep computer games or interactive fiction around for a significant period of time. And just sort of going back and forth, they realized there was an opportunity to work with Library of Congress on their large digital preservation effort, the National Digital Information Infrastructure for Preservation Program. Yeah, far too long a name.
That's a mouthful. I mean, can you talk about your personal interest in this and your desire to be a part of it?
So before I came to the faculty here at the U of I, I was actually working at New York University, heading up their digital library team. And we participated in some very early NDIP-sponsored work on preserving, actually, digital public television. So when the entire public television system switched over to digital production and distribution change, people started worrying about, okay, how do we keep this stuff around? And that started getting me interested in the issues both around preserving digital information generally, but also how do we preserve these much larger, more complex forms of digital media that really aren't things we can just print on acid-free paper and keep around as an alternative.
And there are, a list of potential games that will be part of this. And
right.
And the theme here is virtual world.
Right. So what we were trying to do with the games we selected to study was try to get a really broad range of games from different parts of computing history, different genres of game, games that would present a number of different issues in terms of both technical issues and social issues, particularly issues around intellectual property. So we've got everything from Space War on the PDP-1 computer, which has got a strong claim to being the first true computer game ever invented, developed at MIT back in 1962, through console games like Star Raiders on the old Atari system, through modern massive multiplayer systems like Second Life.
So I think one of the key questions here, and I think it may have been asked of you or someone else in the project before, is preserving something for which the game system, or in the case of the first game, as you mentioned, the system doesn't right. really exist anymore.
There is one, count them, one functioning PDP-1 computer left in the world that I know about. It's at the Computer History Museum out at San Jose. So yeah, if we want to preserve the game, keeping the hardware around really isn't a feasible strategy for most of these items. Although I've been shocked to find how many people still have Atari 2600 consoles sitting in their attic that they're willing to donate to us. But we need to figure out a way how to keep the game viable separate from the hardware it was intended to run on. So for many of these games, we're looking at two strategies, either migrating the game onto new operating systems and new hardware. That is a feasible option when you've got a copy of the source code. So I've got a copy of one of our games, Mystery House, designed for the old Apple II, sitting running on my iPhone at the moment. You can also look at emulation, trying to provide a virtual recreation of the original operating system and hardware for the original game to run under. That has the advantage that you actually can keep the original artifact around. You can keep the game unchanged so that people can study it. We have found that some of those emulators that are in use today are actually a little brittle and don't provide a perfect experience of the game.
Does support for this, some of that come from social media, and that we could go to YouTube now and watch a clip of Doom or one of these other things that might be that is expected to be on this list?
One of the things I think is the most interesting about our project is, unlike a lot of the rest of the digital preservation field, we have one of the very few media types where there is a huge pool of extremely talented people willing to volunteer their labor for free. The rest of the digital preservation community doesn't have people going out and writing emulators as open source tools and making them generally available. We're lucky enough to actually have that. So one of the things we've looked at a lot in our project is how do we bring those open communal efforts of the gaming community together with the institutional resources that somebody like the Library of Congress can make available so those communities can actually work together and help each other out in trying to keep these games viable. So we've actually done some work with the Internet Archive, setting up a special portion of their moving image archive to allow people to deposit information on games. And we're also starting to look at ways in which institutions like the Library of Congress, the U of I, might work with open source efforts to make sure that emulators that are developed are made widely available and actually find an institutional home where they'll continue to be made available on an ongoing basis.
Is that, you say open source, I recently did a story on open source textbooks. Is that kind of the same idea there where you, there's some sort of web forum?
The advantage of open source emulators for us is it removes a lot of issues around intellectual property that we might have if we were dealing with a commercial emulator. It's much easier to make these tools generally available. And we have enough problems with intellectual property with the games themselves. So our poster child for bad intellectual property problems is Second Life, because everyone who creates content in Second Life retains copyright over their creation. If I want to archive an island in Second Life under the terms of service I agreed to when I walked into Second Life, I have to get the permission of every single content owner in the island. Even in small islands, that can run to hundreds of people that we have to get the permission before we can actually archive the content.
How long is this projected to take, or is there a term for the funding of this?
So our project will officially wrap up at the end of August, and at that point we're hoping to have archived the games and our case set at both the Ideals Repository here at the University of Illinois and at the Stanford Digital Repository out at Stanford. We'll be doing a final report for the Library of Congress that'll also go up on the website that we have for the project. And we're hoping to actually continue the partnership of all the institutions that are involved, looking at a little more detail about how well do emulators work in terms of providing a good experience of the original game. One problem we encountered with DOS emulators for Doom, one of the other games in our case set, Doom was originally issued for the DOS world before the great consolidation of sound drivers under the Windows DirectX system. This was back in the days when you actually had to set IRQ jumpers on your sound card yourself when you were installing your sound card to get it work. Most DOS emulators really don't do a perfect job of handling all of those old sound card systems. So most of the emulators we worked with Doom could run the game, but almost all of them had serious problems actually reproducing the music that was part of the game.
So what's the next step for you?
What we're hoping to do is continue on a new research project that will involve all the same team members looking at how well we're actually preserving the significant properties of these games when we try something like an emulation approach, and also talking to gamers and people in the game development community about what properties they think are significant and have to be maintained. We'd also like to continue the work we've been doing with the Internet Archive and some other institutions in terms of providing a long-term home for gamer community-developed documentation, websites that they've created to document history of games, providing support for long-term institutional home for things like emulators, seeing what we can do with Library of Congress to actually make some of that community-generated material find a home and find the support that it'll need to stay alive. So the next round of the project is going to involve much more interaction with users and actually bringing in people from the gaming community to test some of these games out, running on both original hardware and on emulated systems and seeing how they behave and trying to talk to both gamers and game developers about what they think is important about games, both some of these older historic games and some of the new ones that we're going to be testing. We're going to be in particular looking at some series of games. So there's some games that have really long-lasting franchises this was after my time in public school, but apparently if you talk to any of our undergraduates today and mention the game Oregon Trail, you'll hear that all of them played this at some point. And that game has been in constant production pretty much since the late 1970s. So we want to look at versions of that game over time and start looking at, okay, in theory, this is the same game. What are the aspects of it that have remained unchanged? What is it that makes the game Oregon Trail the game Oregon Trail? What changes and isn't necessarily significant about the game? And start trying to look at both the content and look at what people say is important about the game and trying to figure out what is the essential aspect of this material that we have to preserve.
And with something like Oregon Trail, I mean, you move on to different themes or ideas?
Right. So what we would be looking at is sort of the, if you've got a long-running game franchise, whether it's Oregon Trail, Civilization, even Doom, which has had come out in several different versions over the years, there are going to be thematic aspects, visual aspects, maybe even technical aspects that keep being maintained throughout the franchise. What are those? No one's really done a good sort of taxonomic analysis of a series of games to say what is it that makes a game part of a series over time. So we're hoping that identifying that will give us sort of a first cut at what is significant about a game, what makes a game a particular game, and we can use that to start talking with end users and game developers about what they would like to see us preserve when we start trying to preserve these types of materials.
Jeff Bosser talked with U of I Library and Information Science Professor Jerome McDonough about the Preserving Virtual Worlds project involving the U of I, the University of Maryland, Stanford University, and Rochester Institute of Technology. Researchers will require another grant to protect more games. They've already submitted their application to the Institute of Museum and Library Sciences. A description of the initial project can be found online at pvw.illinois.edu. This is Sidetrack. It may seem like a dream job, spending the summer outdoors, doing nothing but talking to vacationers, catching their attention and making them laugh. But for people like Basil Truitt of Ocean City, Maryland, the entertainment hides the real hard work involved when you're a wait guesser along the beach boardwalk.
Now who's next? Who's ready? Age guessing, weight guessing, and birthday month guess here. You fool me, and you win. Are you ready? Come on over, don't be shy now.
Well, my name's Basil Truitt, and I'm just guess age, weights, and birthday months.
All you gotta do is fool me once, and you win now.
All right, I'm gonna go with about 217. That's my guess. Let's see if you make that. 216, I got you. That's within three.
See, it's more just trying to entertain people, actually. You know, you got to make them laugh because it's not the person who's playing. It's the person out there that you want to play, you know. You got to try to make them laugh. If they're laughing and they're having a good time, they're going to play and they're going to try it.
Your weight? All right, how about if I go with about 200 and let's just say 210. There you go. Let's see if you make it there. 215, you got me.
I'm going to work, it'll be 102 straight days. But I never stop. I've been working 7 days a week since New Year's Eve.
All right, what are we guessing? Your age? All right. I can tell all the girls no violence now if I go too high, all right? Hey, guessing a woman's age, that's the dangerous part of my job. I'm going to write my guess here, and then I'm going to ask you, all right? I'm going to put you down to be about, how old are you, 18 or 19? You can tell me. That's exactly what I said, honey, 16. I got you.
It's a self-taught thing. Nobody can teach you. You know, it's like you look at people and you know who your friends are and how old they are. You know, your nieces, nephews, cousins, relatives, how old. That's the only thing you got to go by.
I'll tell you how young you look, not how old you feel now.
And when a really, really big guy comes up, it's automatic four something. You know, just take a stab at it. You know, like the other day, I said 420, the guy weighed 424, and the crowd clapped. I lost. But I still thought it was the best guess I had because I got that close with that big a guy. You know? I just got to have something to do.
And
that feature was produced by A. Randall Wenner. When independent producer Robin Amer first moved to Chicago, she didn't really know anyone. Her new Chicago friends decided they were going to adopt her and show her what the town was all about. High on their list of priorities was introducing Amer to Malort. You might say Malort is Chicago's signature drink. For the uninitiated, here is the story of a fond obsession with this two-fisted liqueur.
If you've never tried Malort, I really don't know how to recommend it to you. On one hand, if you've never had it, you're missing out on something authentically Chicago. On the other hand, it's disgusting.
Aspirin, Tylenol, and a little bit of pine. That's my opinion.
Like burnt wood.
It is like wood.
Some burnt.
Most first-time drinkers of Jepsen Malort reject our liquor. Its strong, sharp taste is not for everyone.
How's that for a ringing endorsement? Yes, Malort is a kind of liquor. It's kind of amber-colored and comes in a big bottle with an old-timey-looking label emblazoned with the Chicago flag.
Our liquor, with its brusque taste, is produced by macerating an unusual species of herb which grows wild on northern European mountainsides. Only one hand gathering in 4 years can be expected to produce that unique taste of Jepsen Malort.
For the longest time, it was manufactured and bottled right here in Chicago, hence the flag and the hometown pride. And even though it's bottled in Florida now, you can really only get it in northern Illinois. I first found out about Malort from my friends Coyote and Brandon. This is Coyote.
It's awful, but now I'm hooked. It's a love-hate relationship.
Coyote is kind of a character. He has a big mustache and big glasses and loves the absurd and the eccentric. I've seen him set off fireworks at the Bloomingdale tracks and attack a piñata with a samurai sword. He's obsessed with R. Kelly, but also Werner Herzog. And his bike is covered in dozens of tiny dog stickers and the phrase, "Who let the dogs out?" in big stick-on letters. So yeah, he's kind of a hipster, but he's also awesome. When I first moved to Chicago and didn't really know anyone, Coyote and our other friend Brandon decided they were going to adopt me and show me what this town was all about. High on their list of priorities was introducing me to Malort. So after trying it out at the Happy Bar at Ukrainian Village, we went over to Binny's on Grand and Wells to pick up a bottle and pass it around.
So we're walking through the wine aisle to the liquor aisle.
Oh, these all kind of look like Malort bottles. They're all like brown. Okay, we need to find the Campari, and I think it's going to be with the Campari because they're both really bitter.
Oh, there it is. Look, right there.
Oh, wow. There we go. Are you man enough to drink? Oh, wow, they redid the label. It actually looks like it was made in like the 1990s now. This is good. Jepson's Malort liqueur.
Are you man enough to drink our two-fisted liquor?
Yeah, this is good.
Bottle in hand, we head over to the Fulton Market District, where a bunch of bike kids are standing around drinking and doing tricks on their bikes.
I should say that we're standing in an industrial parking lot, which seems like a really appropriate location to be doing this.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of pimping and body dumping done in this district, so really an appropriate liquor for this scenario.
Coyote pulls the bottle of Malort out of his bag.
Oh my God! Who brought that? Did you?
We did.
Wait, what is it?
Here's the deal.
You've never had it?
No, I have not.
You have to try Malort. Something completely different than
kind of
you've
liqueur?
Ever had.
It is a liqueur.
Actually, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a two-fisted liqueur.
I'll take a demo shot.
All right, Haley, here's the deal. It's not that scary, and it's kind of a Chicago rite of passage.
Oh, God!
The ingredients won't disgust you.
And drink it.
Just what? Have
take a swig.
Take a big
swig.
Don't
you can't
don't
smell it.
Don't smell it?
No, you gotta just do it.
Do a full
never
shot.
Do that.
Full swig.
Solid.
There you go.
It's not bad.
Yeah!
Nice! Woo!
Doesn't really taste like anything.
Keep recording.
Besides, like, cleaning water? Detergent or something.
Whatever, she's drunk. Go Alex, your turn.
Solid.
There you go.
Aspirin, Tylenol, and a little bit of pine.
I must admit. Yeah, it's kind of piney.
Yeah.
I don't buy any of this. Look at that. Look at that face
this
right there.
This is just, yeah, it's a
look
nasty.
You didn't detect
like...
any subtle like flavors of charred oak or
vanilla? Step forward, my friend.
You know,
what's your name?
It's not.
Rudy.
It's not.
Here we go.
Good sway, good sway.
Like burnt wood.
It is like wood.
Some burnt.
Yeah, it's very burnt.
Hold on. It's still some new flavors are still.
They come
it's
up.
It's burnt wood.
You got at least a good 5 to 10 minutes before it goes away, so you have plenty of time to think about it.
Yeah. Definitely some burnt wood. It's awesome.
So I will give a prize to the person who comes up with the most creative Malort mixed drink.
Oh my, no.
Malort? Orange juice with a splash of grenadine, and it would be a Swedish sunrise.
Oh!
Okay,
good.
I can see
last
that working.
Last night at T&M, they were telling us that Malort and tonic is actually a decent drink.
Are you
but
serious?
I don't feel the need to waste tonic on that.
All this talk of Malort mixed drinks reminds Brandon of another bar that also serves it. And one epic night, they all tried to go there.
So shortly after Coyote and I had discovered Malort, for ourselves, we found out that this place called Motel Bar has 25-cent shots of Malort on Mondays. We posted on the internet. We thought this was going to be a great idea. We were going to get a whole bunch of people to just rush into Motel Bar, a whole bunch of dirty bikers in their swanky lounge, and order nothing but 25-cent shots of Malort. Turns out there was a completely epic downpour that night, right as everyone was coming home from work. So everyone was already soaked, and Coyote calls me from the California Clipper, and he's like, "We're already wet, we're still gonna go, just do it." So I meet them there. E. Farrar is with us, who has been to a concert early in the evening, is already smashed,
I don't
totally,
even
totally
that.
Hammered. And the only other person that was actually willing to go with us was Coyote's ex. And so we ride through the pouring rain from California to the river to get to Motel Bar, running all of the lights along the way as E. Farrar blows through every intersection yelling clear without looking for traffic.
What's your point? What's your point?
We got to Motel Bar and ordered shots, and the dude looked like he had never, ever seen anyone order the drink. since he'd been working there.
He had never actually had anyone come in there and order Malort from him before, so he gave us a bunch of the rounds for free. And then there was
shots with us.
And he was taking shots with us. And they were big shot glasses too. So we had already had like
they were like whiskey glasses,
yeah,
basically.
So yeah, I was pretty messed up. And I started arguing with my ex-girlfriend. So
I cut out shortly before that happened.
Which was an excellent idea.
Sewer grate. Didn't tell anybody. I walked straight out the door, sewer grate.
Rode home.
You wasted all that good Malort.
Oh god.
And we totally left wet butt prints all over the swanky furniture because we were totally completely soaked.
And so that's basically how our what was supposed to be a weekly affair, Malort Mondays, never happened again.
The first and last Malort Monday.
I think we could go there, like right now.
Huge. Dude, huge, where are you? Ashland, Milwaukee, we're going to Motel Bar.
Alright, should we do this? So we just tried to order some Malort. Do you have any?
I don't think we have any now. We normally carry it. But.
Yeah. Do people, like, actually come in and order it?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Because it's 25 cents.
Yeah. So why is it that cheap?
Why?
Yeah.
Because it's gross. Really? It's like eating a dandelion.
How often do you have to restock?
Quite a bit. We sell quite a bit.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, how fast do you go through it?
At least a bottle a month.
Okay.
At least. I mean, we always have at least... We normally have two or three bottles on hand at all time, but...
Whenever they're at the bar and they're like, it's my birthday, can you buy a shot for me? We're like, yeah, we have something for you. So literally this one girl... Do you remember that night that I gave the group of girls a shot? And she was offended. She said that was the worst thing I've ever tasted and I'm not coming back here again. And I was like, no, I didn't mean it like that, you know.
And you don't have any right now?
No.
Oh,
I can double check.
Would you double check? Okay, thank you. They have it. Oh man.
We'll send a shot over to everybody.
Oh man, that's awesome. Thank you so much.
How many shots do you have?
Yeah, how many people are over there?
There's a lot of us. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, we'll stay for a drink then. Now that there's more,
so,
yeah.
Alright. Actually, I'll bring these over.
Alright.
What happened?
I knew it.
They found a bottle, and they're giving us 11 free shots.
It's on us, on the house, apparently.
It's on the house.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. My faith is restored.
Does everybody have a shot?
I think so.
Hey, Evan, everybody, raise your glass. Down it.
Oh man, that is so foul. But it's so good.
That story from Robin Amer, an independent producer based in Chicago. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.